Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. As you can tell, we are in a modified and somewhat compressed mobile studio today. We are very pleased, though, to be able, as a result, to catch up with one of our most important colleagues and comrades in arms in the fight for our freedoms. He is the Director of Homeland Security Programs at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He's the author of a book that I think has caught a lot of people's attention, including that of Senator Ted Cruz, who had Kyle appear as a witness in one of his very important committee hearings in the Judiciary Committee a while back. The book is entitled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. And Kyle most recently has published in just the past couple of weeks an important sort of complement to that program about another organization or set of organizations, I guess it's better to say, Understanding Black Identity Extremism, Considerations for Law Enforcement is the title of this new book, and we're going to be talking with him about it in the course of this hour. Kyle's expertise and his insights are greatly valued by all of us, and we're very pleased to have a chance to expose all of you to them now. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure.
So introduce this term, Black Identity Extremism. I'm not sure it's familiar to even our pretty erudite audience.
Well, the term is actually not mine. The term originally comes from the FBI, which used this term to describe a variety of different Black radical organizations that they were linking to a series of ambush attacks against local law enforcement. This was in the wake of the BLM riots in 2020, but they really traced it all the way back to the Ferguson riots in 2014. And what they were noting was that there was a correlation and an uptick in attacks on law enforcement coming out of this subset of extremists. Now, when one of their intelligence documents about this threat became public, they took a great deal of political pressure, primarily from the Congressional Black Caucus, but also from a number of left-wing media sources. And basically, the FBI folded like a cheap card table. They abandoned the use of the term Black Identity Extremism. They came up with some other euphemism, which is extremely generic and doesn't even explicitly state what kind of group you're talking about anymore. And they've completely ran away from the term. So what I tried to do with this book was to see if there was actually any validity of the FBI's original premise, which was that you could describe some of these groups which were engaging in these attacks on law enforcement in a cogent way. Is there any connective thread that runs through these various groups? And what I have found is that indeed there is. Indeed, there are a variety of ideological and historical threads that connect these groups together, that influence the way they see the world, that influence their political objectives, and that influence the kinds of criminality and kinds of violence that they do engage in when members of these extremist groups engage in violence. And so my goal was to provide this background information to law enforcement to give them a better chance of understanding the foe that they face.
Implicit in that input is that they're not getting the sort of information that you have marshaled from outfits like the FBI. Is that correct?
I think it's quite correct. We've seen, for example, that the FBI, as I said, ran away from this term despite doing a number of pretty decent intelligence products about Black identity extremism. When they were facing political scrutiny, they ran away from it. And so law enforcement aren't getting that kind of education. Additionally, the kind of education they are getting about groups that fit under this umbrella is oftentimes incorrect. For example, There is a subset of what you might call Black identity extremists known as Moorish Science, or the Moorish Science Temple of America. Now, these are African Americans who believe that they are a member of a nationality group known as the Moors that come out of North Africa. This is obviously historically incorrect, but it is the sort of background story that they have invented for themselves. And as a result, they believe that they are not required to adhere to American laws and that they are not American citizens, but Moorish citizens. This results, as you can probably imagine, in a number of conflicts with law enforcement, as they refuse to carry driver's license, they refuse to get registration for their cars, and these sorts of events. Now, federal law enforcement has essentially called Moorish Science members sovereign citizens. But this is incorrect. And the reason it's incorrect is because the sovereign citizen movement began in the 1970s. And Moorish Science Temple of America has been doing these kinds of things, including issuing national ID cards to so-called Moorish Americans, since the 1900s. So they have been doing this almost 70 years earlier than the sovereign citizens, and yet you have the FBI, you have groups like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center that attempt to lump Moorish, so-called Moorish citizens in with a sovereign citizen movement, even though that makes no historical sense.
Interesting. And Kyle, are there other examples of Black identity extremism that we ought to have in the mix as we think about the implications of what they're up to?
Sure. So the Moors are probably the earliest example of what you might call Black identity extremism. Out of them flows a group that most of your listeners probably are familiar with, which is the Nation of Islam. But we look in the book at the roots of the Nation of Islam, what they believe and why they believe it, and importantly, how this results in their engaging in a wide variety of violent and extremist behavior, ranging from, for example, close ties to the terrorist supporting regimes of Sudan and Libya back when Muammar Gaddafi ran Libya, all the way to attacks on law enforcement and a very famous set of killings in the 1970s known as the Zebra Killings that were conducted by members of the Nation of Islam. So we trace all of those sorts of relationships all the way up to the modern day, where you had a individual attack a Capitol police officer with his vehicle, ran a police officer over, and then jumped out of the car with a machete and was killed in that attack. And he identified himself as a follower of Louis Farrakhan, the leader of Nation of Islam. And so we look at that. But we also look at the impact that Marxists and explicitly the Communist Party of the United States have played upon Black identity and the Black movement in the United States, what they would call the Black liberation movement in the United States. And this also goes all the way back to the very founding of the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks began seeking to use disagreements and the tension between Black and white Americans against America as early as the 1919-1920. And so we trace that route all the way up through what would eventually become the Black Panther Party, their obsession with Mao and his guerrilla tactics, all the way through their affiliation with Castro's Cuba, with the FLN of Algeria. And as we start to head into the modern era, you get modern BLM and their affiliations with, for example, the Venezuela of Chavez and Maduro. So another important thread in all this is the foreign subversion angle and the impact it has had on Black Americans and the Black identity.
We're going to come back to the foreign dimension of this. Enemies, foreign and domestic, it turns out. Kyle Scheidler is with us, the author of Black Identity Extremism, Uncovered is another way to put it, Uncovering Black Identity Extremism. We'll be right back with more right after this.
The This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In a Russian provincial capital this weekend, a mob invaded the airport, intent on tearing Jewish passengers limb from limb. That wasn't just an example of resurgent anti-Semitism in the tradition of virulent pogroms conducted in that neighborhood for centuries. It was an example of jihadist bloodlust commanded by the Islamic doctrine of Sharia. Fortunately, the perpetrators did not succeed in Dagestan as they did recently in Israel. The question is, could it happen here? Incredibly similar, potentially murderous violence has occurred of late at Cooper's Union, Cornell University, and the Brooklyn Bridge, among other places. Throughout history, the persecution of Jews does not end with the Jews. Christians and others inevitably are targeted as well. In due course, so will be Western civilization, unless and until it fully submits to enslaving Islamic rule. It's time to choose. Surrender or resist. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with New York Times bestselling author Dick Morris. And when I say that, that doesn't really do justice. He's a serial bestselling author, including, I'm quite sure, that will be true of his new book, Corrupt, The Inside Story of Biden's Dark Money. And Dick, you were going through kind of a litany of things that Biden has done that have really harmed our country and I think without exception benefited, at least indirectly, the Chinese Communist Party. Finish that thought.
There's increasingly a focus on rare earth minerals that are essential to any of Biden's solar and wind turbine energy dream, but also fundamental to our national defense. They power our missiles, our guidance systems, our night vision goggles, and stuff like that. And China has secured a monopoly of those. Virtual, about 80% of the world supply comes from China, and he also made sure that monopoly continued, because there was a major effort by an American company to build a rare earth mineral mine in northern Minnesota. By the Great Lakes region. Mm-hmm. And Biden recently killed the mine, which replaced about a third of our rare earth mineral needs, citing that it might pollute a lake. Mm-hmm. In addition, there are 300,000 Chinese exchange students in the United States.
Yes, indeed.
Trump set up a bureau in the FBI to focus on espionage by those kids, and Biden dismantled it. Mm-hmm. Terminated, no longer exists. China has put missile bases, military bases in Cuba, the very thing that almost caused World War III when Russia did it while Kennedy was president. In the South China Sea, we've allowed them to build artificial islands, which are in effect unsinkable aircraft carriers that can be used to disrupt shipping, claim sovereignty, and eventually invade Taiwan. China has circled the globe with what it calls its Belt and Road Initiative, which goes to third world countries, and they go to a dictator and they say, hey, how would you like a new airport? And the guy says, I don't really need one. He says, well, we think you do, and here's $400 million to build the airport. Do with it as you wish. And the dictator chuckles to himself while he puts it in his Swiss bank account.
Right.
And that
corrupt- and Chinese nationals arrived to do the construction, no less.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, they do.
Bill, we could go on and on about this bill in particulars, but
the important point about this is that they then secure a lien on that country's rare earth minerals, so that in the event the loans are not repaid, and they never repaid, China can own them, and it's a method of creeping colonialism.
Yeah, and the infrastructure they build as well. I mean, they can simply expropriate it. And Dick, I think the point you're making is so important. This is evidence of the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare against our country. And what they have, and I don't know if you know my colleague and friend Sam Faddis, who's a regular on this program, but he's a career undercover operative for the CIA. And he says, in the terms of the trade, and he's, recruited and run agents for the United States all over the world,
He said that the way you would characterize Joe Biden is as, quote, a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party.
That's really unquote. True.
So, you know, that's what we're up against.
That is on his way out of office.
Well, let's hope.
Talk about the election.
Yeah.
I believe that while we're all paying attention to the Middle East and to earlier the House Speaker's race, there has been a total change in the election in the United States. Mm. People for the last 2 or 3 months, people have begun to really see the price we're paying for an enfeebled president, both physically and mentally and morally. And the result has been huge changes and swings in the polling. In 2020, Joe Biden got 12% of the black vote. In John McLaughlin's latest poll this week, he's getting Trump is getting 27%, up from 12. And among Hispanics, he got 27% of Hispanics in 2020, and now he's getting 39. And among Gen Z voters, 18 to 24, there's been an almost total turnaround, from Biden leading by about 10 points to Trump leading by more than 10 points.
Wow.
So the three pillars of the Democratic base, blacks, Latinos, and young people, are absolutely dropping out of the bottom of the Democratic base. And as a result, Biden is now 5 points behind Trump. And bear in mind, he allegedly won by 3 points in the popular vote. Right. So that's an 8-point swing. And 12% of the people who voted for Biden in 2020 now tell pollsters they're going to vote for Trump. Not undecided, but switching all the way over, flipping. And that really, I think, is and of course, this is while Trump has been under indictment. Mm-hmm. And despite the efforts of the judiciary to marginalize Trump, his poll numbers are going up, and his hold on the nomination is now ironclad, and his hold on the electorate is becoming so. So I think that that there's been a sea change because people realize graphically how weak this president is and how incapable of being president he is.
Yeah. I wonder whether I'm in a matter sophisticated and informed one. Clearly, I think most Americans know that Joe Biden in his condition is not actually running the presidency of the United States. I think increasingly people recognize it's kind of what I call Obama-Biden 3.0, this administration. To the extent that it's the case that people recognize that this is an intolerable situation, whether it's the enfeebled president or whether it's the guy running him from behind the scenes, are you sensing there's an actual repudiation of the policies of this administration as well as, you know, the personalities?
Well, there is, but it's on a separate track. I think that in particular, his policies that stem from his environmental so-called commitments on climate change are blowing up in his face. People become increasingly cognizant of the danger of wind energy offshore, of collapsing and killing whales and killing. We've gone from the choice between saving the planet and saving the whales, which the left is facing. And I think also his the EV program for electric cars is falling apart. So I think certainly in that segment there is. I also think there's a revulsion against the loss of personal liberty, requiring EV cars, requiring eliminating gas and oil-powered furnaces to heat your home and replacing them with far more expensive electricity. And all of this serves to underscore the inflation that Biden has almost deliberately brought to the United States by running these huge deficits.
Yeah, I call it a wrecking operation, Dick. I think it's across the board. The damage is incalculable, and energy insecurity, replacing what Donald Trump, you know, famously sought, which was energy dominance, is one of the most egregious examples of it. We'll be talking about this in the course of the program, going back to China, the extent to which we are seeing people like J.B. Pritzker and the governor of Michigan financing the installation of Chinese companies run by a Chinese Communist Party entity called Goshen, factories to produce these lithium that is to say a rare earth mineral, electric vehicle batteries in those states. And I mean, the whole thing is crazy.
When Biden released oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve,
it
went directly to China.
Yes.
Granholm, former Governor Granholm of Michigan, called Premier Xi and told him the oil is coming. And he literally took half a million barrels a day from the reserve and gave them to China.
It comes back to what you said at the outset, Dick, and I can't thank you enough for your clarity on the point. This is treason. This is betraying our country. And I just pray that we survive it. We appreciate your work on behalf of President Trump and what he is trying to do to restore American greatness. And God bless you. Well, it sounds like it. Dick, we have to let you go. Come back to us soon, though, sir.
I will.
God bless you. Bye-bye. Be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of my favorite guests. She is Cheryl Chumley. She is the online editor and a columnist for a great newspaper here in Washington, the Washington Times. She is the author of numerous books, I think the most recent of which is still Lockdown. She's also written very powerfully about the need for Christians to arise in the face of socialism and, well, Marxism, I would call it. And done this in both her, you know, books and columns, and she's a go-to resource on so many of these topics, and we're always delighted to catch up with her. Welcome back, man. I love your t-shirt.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Yes. Yeah, I understand you may be on your way to Israel, which we'll look forward to catching up with you there if you do make it. But I did want to start by talking with you about what your perspective is on what's going on at the moment in the aftermath of the invasion of Israel by Hamas. And now, retaliation, not just from the air, but on the ground by Israel inside Gaza itself.
Well, as you may have guessed from the t-shirt I'm wearing, I'm in full support of Israel's right to defend itself against this terror group, Hamas, which bases its aggression against Israel on religious principles, right? And that's why it's so important to call out the enemy for what it is. And this White House fails to recognize the religious aspects of terror groups like Hamas, like ISIS, like others that all have similar intent and goal to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and to destroy the Jewish people. So I think if we start from there, calling out the enemy for what it is, then we can understand that Israel has a vested interest in eradicating Hamas because the two can't coexist peacefully because terrorists do not want Israelis to live.
Yeah. You know, if I could just tweak what you've said, with which I broadly agree completely. I've come to the conclusion that it's a disservice to talk about these people as terrorists, because in point of fact, as you know, they're jihadists, they're Sharia supremacists, and that there's really not, I think at this point, a dime's worth of difference between Israel's enemies, yes, but our enemies as well, who seek to impose worldwide this Islamic doctrine of Sharia. And to the extent that what we're dealing with, you know, we've all come to understand how heinous the Islamic State is, or ISIS. And if its policies, if its practices, if its methodologies of warfare are really indistinguishable, not only from Hamas's, but from the Taliban's and Hezbollah's and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and so on, what we're up against, isn't it, Cheryl, is really a threat to Western civilization more broadly. And Israel just happens to be kind of a speed bump in the way of getting to us.
Well, I agree with you, Frank. It's always been death to Israel, death to the West, right? Death to America. And so if you look at Europe right now and the problems that they're having with all the illegals that have crossed in from Muslim nations and some of the terror attacks that they've suffered in recent years, you can sort of see that with our open borders right now, that we may indeed be facing that same sort of threat. And maybe that's what Americans need to wake up to, the idea that, you know, this isn't about jobs and economic opportunity and climate change. This is a deep-seated hatred of some in the Muslim community toward all that's liberty, all that's free, all that is Christian, all that is Jewish.
It is. And again, your exhortations to Christians to rise up in the face of these sorts of threats, whether it's these foreign ones that you've talked about or domestic ones, which are imported here through the open borders or that have been cultivated here, for that matter, by the radical left. It's such important work that you've been doing, Cheryl, and I'm so grateful for it. I wanted just to ask you, because, of course, your, you know, trade is reporting and analysis and commentary and so on. What do you make of the kind of reporting that we're getting about this conflict now that Israel is, you know, once again having to contend with the consequences of the jihadi attacks that they've been subjected to?
I'm so grateful for that question, because as you mentioned, I may be headed to Israel, and that is the number one reason why, because I visited Israel December, January, just a few months ago, and I had some sources there, and they've come on my podcast, and they told me one of the number one concerns is the fact that the narrative is being quickly skewed. And you and I, who follow the news and follow global affairs and so forth for years and years, know that this is how terror groups or jihadist groups work, that they, after they are the aggressors, they turn around and they play the victim. And the BBC has fallen in line with this narrative. CNN has fallen in line with this narrative. And there are too many reporters out there who seem to think that it's their job to draw moral equivalencies between Israel and groups like Hamas, which is just trying to draw moral equivalencies between good and evil. It doesn't work. So you can't report on Israel without adding in the context and refuting the idea of Israel as the occupiers and so forth, because historically speaking, factually speaking, that's not true.
Right. Well, no, to the contrary, the occupation that they once had was, you know, ended, I think, back in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just ask you, because in a way, moral equivalency would be preferable to what seems to be increasingly skewed narratives coming out of the press favoring the Palestinians over the Israelis, condemning the Israelis especially. And that's, as you say, this is information warfare. And this is where things typically go, in part because, and that, you know, the example of that hospital that within seconds of, you know, some explosions outside of it, it turns out. There were reports that it had been directly attacked by Israel with, you know, 500 lost lives. And it turned out that none of that was true. But, you know, the old line about the truth is still getting its pants on after a lie gets literally around the world. But this is what we're up against. And I hope you do make it over there safely, of course, and bring your excellent reporting to bear. Let me ask you about one other topic before we have to let you go, Cheryl Chumley. You have recently written about a man we are told is the great hope of the Democratic Party, the man who will, some say, ultimately supplant Joe Biden as the candidate of the party because of his failings, namely Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. We saw him on the world stage, burnishing his foreign policy credentials, I guess one would say, in the company of Xi Jinping, the Chinese communist dictator. You were rather critical of that appearance. Tell us what you made of it and why we all should be.
Well, I think we as Americans need to be aware that this guy may be the Democrat Party's pick for president, and he was already over in China fawning over Xi. And this is something that we need to be concerned with, because it's one thing for Gavin Newsom to go over to China and talk about California will always be a place of economic opportunity and partnership for China. It's another thing for him to go over there and sort of lay the groundwork for, if he is eventually president of the United States, that we as America will allow China to become our economic engine. And I think this is what China loved about having Gavin Newsom over there, and their media over there, their state-run media, just ran roughshod, ran wild with the propaganda showing how America's leading Democrat potential for president is already bowing down to China and communists in China.
Yeah. And as you say, we've had rather too much of that under the present administration, as we were just talking about with Dick Morris. And the idea that this would be a, well, actually publicly pronounced policy of a Gavin Newsom administration would, it seemed to me, pretty much mark the end of the United States as we've known it. I mean, the Chinese are well advanced on trying to take over the world. And you and I have talked about this a little bit in the past. They're moving forward inexorably towards this so-called global governance arrangement through the World Health Organization's empowerment to become now not just an advisory body, but one that will dictate what we can do in terms of our, even our own personal medical freedoms. And your book, Lockdown, really, I think, dissected brilliantly the kind of China model that the World Health Organization helped impose on this country, just as an advisory body, let alone what it would do if it were able to tell us that we have to do that in the future. Cheryl, as you know, there's a lot of evidence that we're looking at a new pandemic, maybe just in time for this election season. Not a good idea to be powering up the World Health Organization further, would you think?
I definitely think, yes. It's, you know, these global entities work together with China and in communist favor, and they're totally in conflict with American principles. And we don't need the next, yes, we don't need the next president of the United States already laying the groundwork for more partnerships and cooperation with these anti-American type of sources.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Cheryl, as always, you're succinct as well as absolutely clear-eyed about the challenges that we're facing. And we so appreciate you as a guest here and as a good friend. And we hope that you will, if you do get over to Israel, travel safely and report in. We'll talk to you
then.
We'll talk to the rest of you on the other side of a very short break, in which we will bring up still more evidence of the trouble we're in. So straight ahead.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In a Russian provincial capital this weekend, a mob invaded the airport, intent on tearing Jewish passengers limb from limb. That wasn't just an example of resurgent anti-Semitism in the tradition of virulent pogroms conducted in that neighborhood for centuries. It was an example of jihadist bloodlust commanded by the Islamic doctrine of Sharia. Fortunately, the perpetrators did not succeed in Dagestan as they did recently in Israel. The question is, could it happen here? Incredibly similar, potentially murderous violence has occurred of late at Cooper's Union, Cornell University, and the Brooklyn Bridge, among other places. Throughout history, the persecution of Jews does not end with the Jews. Christians and others inevitably are targeted as well. In due course, so will be Western civilization, unless and until it fully submits to enslaving Islamic rule. It's time to choose: surrender or resist. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and it's one of the high points of our week, and that is our visit with Bill Walton, a former and recovering Master of the Universe, now the host of a terrific television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show, to which I commend you all. I had a chance to appear on it recently myself with our colleague Brad Thayer, and just reaffirmed the importance that I attach to this really, really thoughtful and informative program. You shouldn't be surprised, because Bill proves to be thoughtful and informative every time he appears here, and we're always delighted to have him do so. Welcome back, sir. It's good to have
Frank,
you.
Frank, as always, great talking with you.
So we did a webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger China last Friday, of which I'm very proud you are a member. It featured a conversation about a company that I know you're familiar with, Sequoia Capital. And the context was that an investigation that seems to have been stymied for quite some time by the previous Speaker of the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, and in his role as the minority leader prior to that, by relevant committees of the Congress. And the investigation that is now getting underway in the Select Committee on the Communist Party of China is a very promising development, especially given the role that we've been learning about, played by Neil Shen, a Chinese national who is one of the principals in this Sequoia Capital, has been for some time, and has helped turn it into, I guess, the world's largest venture capital fund. You have some breaking news about Neil Shen, and I don't know why it's doing that. You have some breaking news about Neil Shen, Bill, and I wanted to get into it right away, but also to commend to our audience this really impressive webinar at presentdangerchina.org. Tell us about it and what he's up to.
Well, Neil, for years, ran Sequoia's China operation, and one of the reasons he was so effective in China is his extremely close relationship with the Chinese Communist Party, and they allowed him into deals at low valuations, and he made a fortune for himself and his investors. Well, the political heat has been turned up on technology investment and venture capital, and Sequoia last year decided to or maybe earlier this year, decided to split into three pieces. And Neil took the third piece, the Chinese piece, off on its own, and it's now called Hongsheng Ventures. And I think that's actually Chinese for Sequoia. And the interesting development here is that he's got $9 billion in the fund, and he's now announcing that China is not really investable. He can't find a place to put $9 billion, and that he's now spread his sites throughout the world to invest in other more investable regions. Now, the big news there is that if Neil Shen cannot find a place to invest in China, I don't know who can. And we've talked about how President Xi has cracked down on the private sector and venture capital and the ability of investors to do due diligence. Well, it's now turning out that it's hard for Neil, which is really an incredible development. And he'll be presumably investing in companies that are in related technologies to his existing portfolio in China. And of course, that presents a risk to us and our security and our national security, because a lot of those investments will be in technologies that relate to the Chinese war machine. And it's just another thing we need to keep our eye on. But you know, the thing that always disappoints here is that our U.S. investment oversight is in CFIUS, which is part of Treasury. They're not doing anything about this. It's not even on their radar screen. And so once again, we're watching investment dollars move all over the world from China, and we're not tracking it. It's not even remotely on their radar screen.
Bill, this is so troubling on a lot of different levels. I mean, on the one hand, that we've had this Chinese national, who, by the way, has been described by some as an employee of the Chinese Communist Party, an advisor to the Politburo and the like, sitting atop a venture capital fund that has inherently the ability to basically look at and hoover up any kind of technologies that they find interesting. And in this case, evidently relay to the Chinese what they're about, how they're coming, you know, why they might be relevant to the Chinese People's Liberation Army, and so on. And as you say, this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States is asleep at the switch at best, and at worst, what we're seeing is the suppression of investigations into potentially very, very strategically dangerous developments out of Sequoia Capital by the top Republican in the House of Representatives until, thank God, very recently. Again, folks, focus on this, because what we're talking about here is something that will possibly determine much of our national security for years to come. And we've got to get on top of it and root out who's involved that maybe, as Joe Biden likes to say, playing for the other team. Bill, I did want to ask you about another piece of this, and that we have been witnessing the Chinese formalizing and expanding the direct integration of the People's Liberation Army, their military, into major companies in China, specifically, I guess, major state-owned enterprises. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the Chinese have now formalized something which has been apparent to you and me for a long time, and that they've set up actual departments inside the major state-owned Chinese companies, multinationals, and across all industries, really. And the departments are aimed to put the companies on a war footing. And so they've not only formalized the relationship with the Chinese Communist Party, but they've also put the companies on notice that every time they do something, they had to be thinking about what their posture is going to be during a war. And presumably that war is going to be with the United States.
Presumably it is. Bill, hold the thought. We're going to come right back to how very, very troubling that is with Bill Walton on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We are visiting with Bill Walton, one of our gurus on the economy and what is happening to it, particularly the extent to which it is being impacted by what the Chinese are up to and what they're doing to us. And Bill, We were talking about Neil Shen a bit a moment ago and the need to get to the bottom of what he's up to. But what you've just introduced in terms of the war footing that China is putting its companies on, among others, this is a moment that the attention of the American people and their elected representatives needs to be focused like lasers on what's developing here, does it not?
It does, and we've talked about the Biden administration's whole of government approach to addressing climate change and also diversity, equity, and inclusion. And of course, they're focused on exactly the wrong things. They're not at all focused on China, and we saw that with the four cabinet level visits to China recently. And most notably, Janet Yellen's Treasury Department is charged with overseeing Chinese investments in the United States. And, you know, she's taking engagements, engagement with Chinese Communist Party to new extremes, just ignoring most of what they're doing. Also, our U.S. Trade Representative, Catherine Chin, has gone soft in our negotiations in the World Trade Organization. The Trump administration, led by Bob Lighthizer on trade, was very tough in demanding the United States have a role in writing the digital rules and technology exchange and that and all that sort of related things. It's extremely complicated, but basically, I'm sorry, it's not Catherine Chin, it's Catherine Tai. Catherine Tai has pulled back from that, and they're willing to cede some of the rule-writing rules to, of all countries, China. And it's just another example of where we're not seeing what China is clearly. You've accused me of being an apologist for Wall Street and the multinational.
No, I've never done that. Implicated that, in some of its past activities, that's all.
You know, I just don't check my resume.
Just for the record.
But we are capable of change, Frank.
And you have made huge strides, let me just say.
But the
come a long way, baby.
There are two things. One of it is just naivete. I mean, U.S. business people have been taught about for years that we're supposed to engage China. And we did so. And most people have not awakened to the fact that China not only is not investable, but China feels that it is at war with us. The people in the administration should know better. And they're engaging in China as if this were, 1985, and we're just bringing them into the global economy.
Let's get into a specific example of this, because it's profound. And it's against the backdrop of something that we've been talking about and arguing against for some time now in the state of Michigan. And that is the idea that the state government there, and for that matter, the feds, are pouring money into a Chinese company called Goshen to put together and start up an electric battery manufacturing facility to produce batteries for electric vehicles. It turns out that J.B. Pritzker, the governor of neighboring Illinois, is determined to do the same thing there. Goshen is a problematic company. It is a Chinese Communist Party enterprise through and through. And what are we to make of not one but two of these governors pressing forward with this kind of investment of our money, no less, at considerable expense?
Well, Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois is running hard for becoming the worst governor in America, and that's a hard honor to earn. There's so many bad ones right now, particularly that young man from California. But having successfully chased Boeing and Caterpillar and Citadel, the big hedge fund, out of Illinois, he's now trying to restore some manufacturing capability in Illinois by bringing in Goshen, which is a big battery manufacturer, and they want to provide subsidies that essentially, he's talking about new jobs, it would essentially cost $200,000 per job. And, so it's not only is this absolute economic waste of taxpayer dollars, but it's in a technology batteries that I think we're going to find 10, 5 years from now, will become essentially uninvestable. You know, some vehicles now, you can't get insurance on them because we can't figure out how to repair these batteries once they're put in cars. But the other bigger thing is that this is a Chinese company that they're doing this for. And so they're not only putting the fox in the hen house by bringing China in, but they're subsidizing them to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, hundreds of
I'm
millions.
I'm sorry, I overstate. Sorry. I guess these numbers, I'm like Everett Dirksen.
Well, with the Biden team, subsidies.
The whole of government approach is probably a couple trillion. But
yeah, I think that's right. No kidding.
It's a smaller number.
So, Bill, one of the other things that we've been concerned about is the kind of pressure, as I talked about in connection with Sequoia Capital, but also, you know, the people who are frantically trying to do business with the Chinese Communist Party in Michigan and Illinois, is the influence that the Chinese are exerting here. And our friend, and I want to get him on the show, see if we can talk with him about it directly, but former Congressman Frank Wolf, one of the real heroes of the fight against tyranny, has recently come up on the net and said, we ought to ban lobbying for China. And by that, I think he means the American entities that are doing that lobbying. But what are your thoughts about the importance of such a step?
Well, Frank, who spent years in Congress and knows how Congress works, has just come out recently and said point blank, Congress should ban lobbying for China. And you know, you stop and think about it. What kind of lobbying firms did we have set up in the United States lobbying on behalf of the Soviet-Russian enemy? Well, China's an entirely different category. They have hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of lobbyists, both directly lobbying Congress for what they want, but also indirectly through a lot of the proxy firms like BlackRock and J.P. Morgan, all the other businesses.
They're old friends, as they call them, Bill. We're out of time. I can't believe it. It's flown by so fast. And we got about 16 other things to talk to you about. So come back next week and we'll catch up on more of the, there'll be more then too, I'm sure.
A lot going on.
God bless you. It's great to talk with you, Bill, as always. Great to talk with the rest of you. Come back tomorrow for more. Until then, go forth and multiply.